Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at wbez.org/events.
9/11. The stock market crash in 1929, the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, and the riots of the DNC in 1968. These are dates with a clear before and after, dates that shaped what has to come in profound ways. There's no doubt that the most recent pivotal moment was when the COVID-19 pandemic hit in 2020. It sent us on a new trajectory as individuals and as a nation. I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. When the nation went into lockdown, we saw big shifts in how we interacted with each other, who we could see, where we worked. There was an unrelenting uncertainty about the future. But 2020 was a year marked not only by COVID, but also by a contentious presidential election, the spread of misinformation, and mass protests over racial injustice. NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg is out with a new book that charts the transformation that began that year. It's called 2020, One City, Seven People, and the Year Everything Changed. And while it focuses on lives and stories from New York City, so many times while reading it, I saw Chicagoans in my mind, my friends, my family, my neighbors, my coworkers. I sat down with him to learn more about the people he chose to profile in the book. Here's Eric.
I did someone from every borough. I focused, I guess, on ordinary people whose stories were not about what was happening in the White House or in health agencies or even in hospitals, but people we can relate to. And I did it because so much of 2020 was about this overwhelming human experience of just having too much happen to us too fast. And our coping strategy, for most of us at least, was just to try to block it out and survive. And so when we learn, for instance, about a person like Mei Li, who is an elementary school principal in Chinatown, who teaches at the school that she went to as a student, and saw her job in 2020 is trying to help all of her families get through, find a way to do remote education, make sure that they got meals when the school closed down, because kids in New York City schools get 2.5 meals a day from their public schools. And we're willing to fight through just about everything to take care of the people around her. That's not the usual COVID story we tell, but it's a story about 2020 we need to know.
All of the characters, had their own unique stories, whether it was skepticism over getting a vaccine, helping their own families navigate childcare, or having a partner who works as a corrections officer at Rikers. But I want to talk about Daniel Presti from Staten Island.
Yeah.
He had nothing to lose in his mind.
So Daniel Presti, he's the Staten Island representative in the book, and his story stands for a lot of what was happening in Staten Island. It's the most conservative borough in New York, and it's an outlier in New York City, but it's very much like a lot of places in the United States where the experience of 2020 was one of radicalization to the right. And Daniel's story is there because he was managing a bar that opened in late 2019. He and his partner had actually applied for a liquor license in the beginning of 2019, and for reasons that they never understood, but that will probably be familiar to anybody in Chicago who's ever applied for a liquor license, it took almost a year to open their business, and they invested a lot of money and a lot of time. By the time they finally got the okay from the state, the pandemic was about to start. And so instead of a roaring opening, Danny Presti found himself struggling to stay afloat. The business was too new to get a lot of government assistance. His family depended on his income, and it wasn't coming. And after a lot of frustration, asking the government if they could meet with him to explain the situation, when could he open up his business, he decided he'd had enough. And with his partner, he declared his bar an autonomous zone, which meant put a bunch of tape around it, got some poster board at Home Depot, and put up signs saying they weren't going to be following the laws of New York. And they invited people to come into their bar, even though the bar was technically shut down. Well, of course, the police came. But in addition to the police, hundreds and maybe more than 1,000 right-wing activists from around the country, including the Proud Boys, came to Staten Island to show their support for this gesture. And, you know, Danny's story is a remarkable journey because you see, I think, a pretty sympathetic character who started the year without really strong political views, trying to start a community hub, trying to get a business going, find himself unable to get his moorings. And he discovered that everything fell apart and decided to blame Democrats. And so I told his story not because it's my story, it's not because I believe in him, but because I think it's important for people who live in, you know, Democratic-leaning places like Chicago or New York to understand that some people had a really different experience. And, you know, as a sociologist, I take my job to be to help you get in the shoes of people who are different from you. And so he's an outlier in the book, too. But his story is really important, not for us to judge him. I'm not here to, you know, remake a trial, but because we need to understand.
And also, as a sociologist, you understand the value of observing rumors and conspiracy theories. And so I mentioned that you did your own research and analyses in this book. Talk about what you saw on social media and what that said about trust.
Yeah, well, a lot of things happened on social media. In fact, a lot of us experienced the bulk of the pandemic through social media. With a postdoctoral fellow who was working with me that year, Melina Sherman, we analyzed tens of thousands of Facebook posts, including the action in these Facebook groups. And one of the things we learned is that people in 2020 gravitated to groups that stood for their interests and ideological positions. And so if you tend to get your news from a progressive movement or from a progressive group, you know, for you, the story of 2020 was about the failure of the Trump administration. It was about our collective refusal to wear masks and recognize the way in which our personal health is tied to your personal health, the ways in which we're connected to each other through the way we breathe and share space. It's a story about unnecessary suffering and terrible leadership. And lots of people who are riding with Biden, as one of the groups was called, used Facebook groups to narrate that account and to kind of build solidarity that way. But that didn't become the dominant story in the country because there was a whole other swath of humanity that was over on the right wing Facebook groups where, you know, they spent time talking about, you know, Democrats and socialists who, in their view, were overreaching and trying to control them with, you know, mask mandates and vaccine mandates and closures that were punishing them and punishing society. You might recall the lieutenant governor of Texas during 2020 got on television and said, you know, we were done with all the lockdowns, even though, by the way, we never really actually locked down in America compared to other places. But the lieutenant governor said, old people are willing to die if it means getting the economy back up and running again. Now, I don't remember that vote. I wasn't sure that anyone really felt that way. But that was the story that was being represented on the right. And then, of course, the one place where we all came together is that set of viral videos where we could see Americans fighting each other in Walmarts and Home Depots, Starbucks, over whether or not it was okay to wear a mask. That didn't happen in other countries in the world. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is I wanted people in the United States to understand just how unusual and dysregulated our experience was. Things really fell apart in the United States in a way that they did not in most other societies on Earth. And, you know, I can imagine that not everybody wants to go revisit 2020. It wasn't the best of times, but we are living through a period marked by all of the things that got whipped up and hardened, accelerated in 2020, the distrust, the division, the anger. And in a way, like, I'm concerned about the long COVID we have now as a social disease. And I think we have to go back and make sense of what we lived through.
Let's talk about race. I worked on a project with my colleagues here at WBEZ in 2020 that was called 50 Lives in 4 Zip Codes. So you can imagine Streeterville near Northside, low deaths, South Shore, West Side, high deaths. We saw the disparities, and this was not unique to Chicago. What is the relationship between health disparities and place-based inequities?
Well, that's a question that I started thinking about decades ago when I wrote this book about it, the heat wave in Chicago, which I still like to come on BEZ and talk about just about every July. You know, what I wrote about the heat wave is that the spike in deaths that we saw on the west side and the south side of Chicago was really just a reflection of the fact that there's a spike in deaths there compared to the other parts of Chicago on a daily basis. The extreme event just makes it more clear. That's very much what happened again during the pandemic. The underlying vulnerability is an issue, but so too is the fact that during the early days and months of the pandemic and for much of 2020, we encourage people to stay home, close schools, close the offices, except for people we called essential workers. Now, I'm from New York City now, native Chicagoan, but I live in New York, and when people hear things like essential worker in New York, they think, oh, they must be talking about the bankers. Hey, you must be talking about the lawyers. Maybe you're talking about the Knicks. But those weren't the real essential workers, and those are not the real essential workers. The real essential workers are people we depend on for all the day-to-day things, like custodians, people who work as clerks, people who deliver food, right? People who manage infrastructure, our transit workers, healthcare workers, not just the doctors and nurses, but, you know, the people who keep the hospitals clean and provide food. Obviously, people in agricultural industries, the meat packers, right, the poultry plant workers. And in the United States, to be called essential was to be deemed expendable, because we send people out without giving them masks, without PPE, without good access to healthcare. And one reason why life was so much more dangerous in our poor neighborhoods, black and brown neighborhoods as well, is because a lot of black and Latino people work in the essential labor market. They were called essential. And when they came home, they were much more likely to spread the disease that they were more exposed to the people in their families. So that's an enormous driver that's very significant. And so too is just the underlying health disparities that mark everyday life as usual.
And then blaming those people for their underlying conditions.
As we always do.
Language also matters. You quote my friend and Northwestern anthropologist, Adia Benton. Talk about how naming infectious diseases contributes to violence and to discrimination.
Well, the story begins with an account of a woman named Mei Li, who's the principal of elementary school in Chinatown. And, you know, Mei early on in 2020, even in Chinatown, started getting harassed by people in the street. There was an enormous spike in anti-Asian hate in the U.S. and in many parts of the world during 2020. And it was especially acute in the U.S. because the previous president thought it was fun and funny to talk about the China virus or Kung flu. He filled the airwaves with this kind of racist rhetoric, and it had a real impact. And so I think the kind of shocking spike in anti-Asian sentiment and the shocking spike in violence is pretty clearly attributable to the way that our names shape our minds. And Adia's research is important in part because it tells us there's a history of stigmatizing people and places in pandemic situations. We used to, you know, refer to the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, MERS, and I think we are reluctant to do that these days in the research community. And actually, one reason why it took the WHO a very long time to put out the kinds of public health, you know, warnings that we might have expected is that they were so sensitive about, you know, getting China to be associated with this disease. I think they were rightly worried about what might happen if people did the kinds of things that our previous president did. You know, unfortunately, in this country, our racial rhetoric often gets activated in these dire moments, and it happened in 2020, and it's a big part of the story for why we experienced this year so unequally.
You do write about all the mutual aid that happened in New York, and Chicagoans will remember that that happened here, and it was beautiful to see people coming together. However, there's this fantasy that a global health crisis is going to create opportunities to do things differently. Like that was said in 2020. Here's our chance. If we are doing the same things later that we did before, we have failed when it comes to changing healthcare systems, how we treat essential workers, addressing racism, inequity.
Yeah.
And yet here we are.
I mean, there were so many moments in 2020 where, despite everything, you could see these glimmers of hope. I mean, there's nothing like the protests, you know, for racial justice that gave us that feeling. But also, there were moments in the debate about essential workers where you thought, oh, maybe we will do the right thing by working people. And we did some extraordinary things. The CARES Act was an amazing expression of, you know, commitment to keeping Americans above water economically. Child Poverty Reduction Act. And we lifted more children out of poverty than at any point in our nation's history in 2021 when that passed. But all of those measures proved to be short-lived. And I think what's so disturbing to so many people is that we did get to the edge. You know, we were at this moral precipice where you could see a breakthrough. Another world seemed like it was going to be possible. We told ourselves, we've learned something here. We won't go back. We will make this commitment to each other. Well, I think that's still happening in a lot of neighborhoods and in our politics and in our policies.
Not systemic change.
We've just acted like none of that happened. And I think one other reason I've written this book and I ask us to think more seriously about 2020 is because we did make certain principled commitments to a better world. And in our rush to move on and act like things were normal again, I think we've buried a lot of those things. We created these black boxes and shoved everything in them and then threw them in the closet. And I don't think the story's over yet. And the reason I'm not completely despondent is that although we haven't yet lived up to the promises we made during 2020 when everything was up for grabs, right? There's this amazing phrase, all that was solid melted into air. And we still have a possibility of building something different. We were pretty close a few years ago. I mean, there was legislation that would have, you know, created more social programs, more investment in social infrastructure and jobs, in public goods in America than anything we've done since the New Deal. And it was one vote, you know, one senator from West Virginia away from passing. But the story's not over yet. There are tremendous possibilities. And I guess the reason that the stories of the people like Nuala and May Lee and the mutual aid networks are there is because if the better angels of our nature are going to win out here, it's only going to be because we can channel the energy and the memories of that kind of work. And so we have to tell those stories too.
This book is wonderful. It's necessary. But it brought back a lot of bad memories, and it was a little triggering to read and to go back to March 2020, go back to summer 2020. It's not that long ago. We're still very close to it. How did you process your own memories, anxieties, and emotions while writing this book?
Well, there's a way in which when you're writing a book about something or studying it, you know, as a social scientist, you can kind of get control of the object, right? You objectify it and you put a certain distance between yourself and the thing you care about. And so, you know, you have files and charts, and instead of just having it run in circles in your mind at night when you're trying to get to sleep, there's this structured order for you. And so I started doing it that way. But actually, the reason that I wrote the profiles of the seven people and the reason that the book is really animated by their stories, think of them as the soul of the book, is I realized as I was writing those kind of puzzle-solving chapters that they weren't really helping to unlock the deeper, more human part of the experience, the traumas that I had, the fears I had. I worried about my job, my future, all of us. And all of that stuff wasn't really getting tapped by the analysis. And so I started to listen really closely to the stories of ordinary people who were trying to get through that year. And I found when I spoke to May Lee and Nuala Doherty and Brandon English and even Danny Presti in his own way from Staten Island, that their stories were helping me unlock things that I had buried inside of me. And it actually felt hard. You're right. It's not easy to read some of these stories, but immensely satisfying and productive. Like I was working through something that I had repressed. And there's something extraordinarily cathartic and helpful about sharing our memories and not just letting them act on us without us being cognizant of it. So, you know, in the same way, someone who's, you know, experienced some traumas as a kid shouldn't react as an adult by just pretending like they didn't happen. I think it would be wrong for us to act like we weren't part of this. And I think they remind us of the remarkable human capacity we have to work through these situations and build something better together.
We've been speaking with NYU sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. His new book is called 2020, One City, Seven People, in the Year Everything Changed. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by me. It was edited by Meha Ahmad and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. Come back to the pod tomorrow afternoon for our weekly news recap, where we share what you need to know about the biggest stories in Chicago and Illinois. I'm Natalie Moore, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wondered why anyone drinks Malort? Or if there are actually lobsters in the Chicago River? Then listen to the Curious City podcast, where we answer all your questions about Chicago and the region. WBEZ's Curious City is part of the NPR network and available wherever you find your podcasts.